On this episode of the Green Street Beat, we're answering common questions regarding the COVID-19 vaccines, discussing the latest on distribution, and much more on the COVID-19 pandemic. Let's dive in. I'm joined by Dan Manley, who is Lee Summit's Assistant Fire Chief and co-chair of the Kansas City Regional COVID Vaccine Workgroup. And also Dr. Steven Solansky, who is the Partners in Primary Care Medical Director and the co-chair of the city's Health Education Advisory Board. Thank you both for being on the podcast today.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Thank you.
So the focus of this episode is on the COVID-19 pandemic, the available vaccines, and the distribution of those vaccines. From your perspective, does it seem like things are ramping up in Missouri and throughout the country regarding vaccine distribution? I know there were a lot of early struggles, but it does seem like the percentage of the population receiving at least one dose is starting to go up fairly steadily.
I would say yes, things are ramping up. And because there are many activities that are occurring across the country because of Operation Warp Speed, the manufacturing process with the different vaccines that are available, and then the improvement in the supply chain as far as the ability to increase those deliveries across the states, we're seeing that give us a greater capacity within the state to do that vaccination effort.
What's the biggest difficulty right now facing the state and the Jackson County region when it comes to vaccine distribution?
Availability of inventory. The vaccine is coming in at limited quantities. So the state of Missouri originally was receiving around 60,000 doses of vaccine per week. Right now, we're up to about 75,000 doses of vaccine per week. And so with a population of just under 6.5 million, it's going to take a while at that level to be able to have equity and distribution of vaccine across the state.
I think there's also been a little bit of difficulty with some changing ways that the vaccines were allocated and how the state changed the focus of allocation. And so we now have a pretty set allocation quantities for the state of Missouri, at least through this month of February and maybe into March, with, you know, various amounts of vaccine being distributed to what are called the high throughput health systems, getting the majority of the vaccine to give in the state, smaller amounts given to the local health departments and to federally qualified health centers and to private practice types of groups. There's now also some federal vaccine that's being distributed to some of the pharmacies locally, and it's not every pharmacy, and so how that's being distributed is something that we're still, you know, working on and seeing how much vaccine is available in that way as well. So there's been a little change in how this is allocated. Hopefully we can get a stable allocation plan going forward. Mass vaccination type of events are also being considered around the state, and there are plans for some of those through the National Guard. So a lot of different ways and places where the vaccine is being distributed and trying to get all that coordinated is I think part of the difficulty too. And I think we're starting to get some of that figured out.
So along those distribution lines, I know Missouri has the tiered system where they break it up, frontline workers, healthcare workers, kind of the front of the line, and then slowly bringing it out to the rest of the public. Do you think that this tiered system has made it a little bit more confusing and harder for people to get vaccinated compared to maybe if they did healthcare and frontline workers first and then opened it up to everyone at one time?
My opinion is that it's really the only way that we could probably do this in an equitable way, looking at the risks and burdens of illness that we have in the population. So, you know, the first groups that were vaccinated were the healthcare workers who are exposed all the time and need to be able to continue to work and not be ill with COVID, along with the highest risk population, which were people in nursing homes and those types of care facilities where there were such high levels of illness. And once an illness happened, that the spread was such, and those people were at such risk that they were, you know, that high numbers of people were dying. You know, then the next levels are basically looking again at the highest risk groups, which are the people, you know, over 65, people with chronic health conditions. And again, recognizing that there has to be some look at how do we get the most benefit You know, with the limited amount of vaccine that Dan was talking about earlier that's out there currently available, and to limit it to, you know, initially to those groups that are the highest risk, because when those people who are older, over 65 or have chronic conditions, you know, get COVID illness, they are more likely to get severe COVID illness, be hospitalized, and potentially die. And so it's sort of that idea of trying to protect those people who are the most vulnerable to the disease. And opening it to the entire population would not have allowed us to have any opportunity to protect that group.
I would just echo Dr. Solansky's remarks. I think when you're dealing with scarce resource availability, being able to have a risk-based tool to be able to reduce the risk of morbidity and mortality in this situation is our priority. And to look at the impact on the senior population, primarily those in congregate long-term care facilities that were at the greatest risk and where we saw significant loss of life and the staff that provides care for them and the healthcare institutions, that population, we're really seeing disproportionate cases in this situation. So to be able to use a tool such as a vaccine to reduce that risk for those populations stops loss of life much more quickly in that strategy.
So has it been difficult with so many organizations involved in this process? So for example, someone could be signed up for registry in Jackson County. They could be signed up with their hospital. They could be signed up with the state so that they're notified whenever they're available to get a vaccine. So what's the coordination like between all those entities so someone isn't canceling their appointment last minute because they already received a vaccine somewhere else and then that dose ultimately is wasted because it can only be stored for so long?
Well, I would just say that with the efforts that take place in the registration across the region, there is some confusion. I think people are so eager to get the vaccine that they're signing in on as many registries as possible. And so one of the activities that we work on throughout the region is to be able to have a common platform to share information and try and make sure that we're able to address some of those challenges. We were on a call earlier today where we were talking about some tools to help deduplicate data from registries to help make sure that we have greater visibility of those populations being vaccinated across the region. But one of the challenges is that we have different jurisdictions that have tools that were in place early in the process. And so to be able to find a mechanism to be able to share information across those different technologies, it requires political will and support within the jurisdictions to have those conversations. And I think that's one of the values of our metropolitan area is that we've got a very collegial environment to share information and to work to serve the population as one Kansas City community. And so as an incident is evolving, it's always chaotic in the early stages of an emergency. And since this pandemic is so protracted, we see improvements as we move through each evolution of this event. And so you'll see that registration process and that information technology improving over time as we go through the vaccination effort.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about the vaccines currently available. Pfizer and Moderna are the two that have received emergency use authorization. And I know some people are a little hesitant because of the speed in which they were both approved. It was a lot faster process than is typical. So what would you say to someone who's maybe concerned about the safety of these vaccines?
I think that it's important to understand that there were really no shortcuts taken in the approval process for these vaccines. The studies were large, they were blinded studies, they were the type of studies that give you the best type of results to know that a vaccine is going to be beneficial. And in those trials, they were showed that both of these vaccines ended up being about 95% effective against the severe consequences or complications of COVID, both Pfizer and Moderna. The data was then evaluated by the FDA. The FDA passed it on to the Committee on Immunization Practices, and then the CDC, and then the vaccines were approved. The FDA actually authorized the emergency use authorization because the benefit of the vaccine outweighed the risks of the vaccine. The safety profiles showed both of the vaccines to be relatively very safe. They both had some side effects, some local side effects, and some mild systemic side effects, which were mostly reaction to the immune process that starts when you get a vaccine, much as like people get sometimes a reaction when they get a flu vaccine. But the incidence of really severe and life-threatening types of reactions was extremely low in both studies. And so the safety pattern was really felt to be, very safe and enough to move forward with the vaccines. I think the speed, one of the things that's interesting about the speed is that, normally you go through various stages of how you do vaccine approvals. And what we did here was because they were trying to ramp up so quickly, during the stage three, phase three clinical trials, they were actually starting to manufacture the vaccine. Usually you would wait till the trials are over and then begin the manufacturing. In these cases, because they were trying to ramp up quickly, they were waiting, and once the phase three trials were completed and they were ready to get their applications and get the approvals, they were already making vaccine so that there was vaccine available when they got the emergency use authorization. So they didn't have to ramp that up. So they were anticipating that they were going to have, a positive result. And the positive result, by the way, was much better than anyone thought it would ever be, the effectiveness of these two vaccines. So so that's why it seems the speed seems faster than normal. But I think everything that was done in the normal processes and to determine the effectiveness and the safety.
These Moderna and Pfizer vaccines, they also utilized a new technology. They used messenger RNA or mRNA. So what is different about that process compared to a traditional vaccine?
Well, the messenger RNA is a new process they've been working on this for many years, but it's the first time it's actually been put into a vaccine. But the messenger RNA actually is a piece of the genetic material from the actual COVID virus, but it is not in an active form that can give you the virus at all, but that is injected into your arm with the vaccine. And it goes into your cells, and just all it does is makes your cells make one little protein called the spike protein off the outside surface of the cell. And once it does that, that messenger RNA is disintegrated and it does not remain in your cell and it's gone. But what it does is it then creates this spike protein. The spike protein is what the body recognizes about the COVID that it forms its own antibodies against. And so it's a new technology it's manufactured in a different way. The lipid solubility is what makes it, has to be, these have to be stored in very, very cold temperatures. And in fact, for Pfizer, a very deep freeze temperature. It's a new technology that's been worked on for many years. First vaccines, actually made in this, with this messenger RNA.
So let's say I get the vaccine, I get both doses, so I'm fully vaccinated. Am I good to go back to my normal routine? Can I see whoever I want to see, go back out to restaurants and just kind of resume life as normal? Or should I still be relatively careful, especially around people who maybe haven't been vaccinated yet?
There's been some information about that. Right now, the recommendation is that we continue with our mitigation strategies even after you've been vaccinated. There's not a risk to you or the person that's been vaccinated. The risk is less in that situation for somebody that's been vaccinated. However, they're still concerned that there may be an ability for the individual to transfer the virus to others. And so, again, similar to the messaging with the mask wearing, you're wearing a mask to protect others in this situation until we are able to get that broader immunity across our society.
Today, Kansas City announced that they were lifting a lot of restrictions related to this pandemic, and especially around bars and restaurants. Does that concern you at all that this, I know cases in Jackson County have been steadily declining, the average positivity rate has been, but does that concern you that if these restrictions are lifted too soon before a large percentage of the population is vaccinated, that we could just end up seeing another spike now?
I would say that as we look at the restrictions and the health orders across the community, there's been significant discussion about the reduction in the caseload that we're seeing in the area, the decrease in hospitalization, and signs of improvement. And so the one message that still is consistent is the need to be able to wear masks and to be able to have good hygiene practices as far as hand washing, disinfecting surfaces. And as long as people follow those mitigation strategies, then it makes sense for us to be able to allow us or our community open up more as we move forward. By the same token, as if we start to see an increase in the cases again, then we have to be prepared to take further action to reduce that risk.
So going back to the available vaccines currently, if I already had COVID, am I still encouraged to get the vaccine?
What we know about COVID illness right now is that that most people seem to have a natural immunity for about 90 days, at least 90 days. But the vaccine still, when it's available, should be given to people, even if they've had COVID illness, because we don't know for sure how long that immunity will last, that natural immunity. And we also don't know when that vaccine is going to be next available. So if you're over 65 and you get an opportunity to get the vaccine, you should get the vaccine. Now, you can't get it if you're actively sick. If you're actively sick with COVID illness, or probably with any illness with a fever, you shouldn't be getting vaccinated at the time with that. And once you're past the contagiousness time frame of COVID illness, then you could get vaccinated. People who are getting, there's a new treatment called monoclonal antibodies, which people can receive outpatient now. It's an infusion of antibodies that help to fight COVID infection. There are a couple of different options of how that works. Those people, because they actually got antibodies, provided to them, they should wait at least 90 days after they've gotten that infusion before they would get the vaccine.
Now that these vaccines, the Pfizer and Moderna ones, have been out for a decent amount of time and more people are starting to get them, are we getting a clearer picture of how long immunity lasts from the vaccines compared to just natural immunity? And is this going to be maybe a yearly thing where we have to get a yearly COVID shot, kind of like a yearly flu shot? Or is it still too early to know these things?
I would say that, when you look at this vaccine development, Operation Warp Speed made their announcement in May of 2020, and then we had the first vaccine available after it had cleared the clinical phase trials that Dr. Solansky was talking about in December. So December 14th is when we had that first vaccine available in the region. So all the evidence was based on those clinical trials and then on the current vaccination efforts. So as we extend the window between the time of vaccine delivery and being able to study these, I think that the scientific assumptions will change based on the data that's collected through this process.
Dan's right. I think we're in the process of still waiting to see how long the immunity is going to last from these vaccines. And actually, I mean, the process is ongoing in terms of the evaluation, both the efficacy and the safety. The FDA is continuing to follow these vaccines over time to see, how long is this effectiveness? Will a repeat vaccine be necessary? Will the fact that there are these mutant viruses, forms of the COVID-19, will that necessitate some kind of a booster or different booster at some point in time? All these are still being studied, and I don't think we know the final answers to these yet.
Along the lines of safety, what would your advice be to women who are pregnant or possibly planning to become pregnant? Should they get the vaccine? Is the vaccine safe?
The studies are just beginning with pregnant women to really try to prove the efficacy and safety of the vaccine for pregnant women. I think what we do know is that women who are pregnant actually have a high risk of severe COVID illness if they were to get COVID, if they were to become infected with COVID virus. And so right now the decision is one that the recommendation is that it's made between that woman and her physician talking about the benefits versus the risks of the vaccines. But the studies directly looking at that patient population are just really beginning. There's no indication that these vaccines will have any harmful effects prior to pregnancy. I mean, the messenger RNA, as I mentioned before, it does not continue in the body. It is broken down and it goes away. It does not stay. And so once a person's vaccinated, you know, there's no indication at this time that it would create any kind of problems given prior to becoming pregnant. And I think the studies now will help us to understand, how it's going to be effective and safe during pregnancy. But under the understanding of the high risk population that pregnant women are for COVID illness.
So we've talked a bit about the Pfizer vaccine and the Moderna vaccine, but the other one that's kind of in the pipeline right now is the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. It's expected to receive emergency use authorization either late February or early March. The biggest advantage it has over the other two vaccines is that it's a single shot rather than two doses. But studies have shown its overall efficacy is lower, but it is still completely effective at preventing hospitalization and death. So if the Johnson & Johnson one is approved, what would you say to someone who's maybe concerned that it has a lower efficacy compared to the other two vaccines?
Well, I mean, I think that when you look at the data, you know, the overall effectiveness in the studies across a variety of several different countries was about 66% effective at preventing moderate to severe illness. In the United States, it was 72% effective. When you look at the overall effectiveness at preventing severe disease, it was 85% effective, which is really very high for any kind of vaccine. It's not 95% like the Pfizer and Moderna, but still very high for most vaccines. And the benefits of a single shot, people will just need to have that discussion, you know, which is the easiest and combined with ease of just one vaccine, which with very low side effects, by the way, in the studies, very low side effects, less side effect really than the placebo, at least in the initial reports. It's the benefit of just having that one vaccine with not quite as just, you know, smaller, you know, incrementally, maybe 10 to 15% less effective. You know, is that beneficial for most people? You know, and I think that's something people have to decide, but for many people it will be, and it's going to be, you know, just probably more available because it doesn't require the same kinds of cold freeze maintenance to store it. So, and I think there'll be more availability once it really ramps up.
I agree with those comments. And I think the other part of that is that you have the additional inventory of vaccine available that really has an opportunity to reduce the impact of loss of life and severe illness, as Dr. Solansky said. And so if we can add more inventory, it gives us the ability to immunize more of our population and reduce that risk and work towards that immunity across the region that would allow us to get back to our new normal.
And I would say that, you know, we're waiting, of course, for the emergency use authorization type of review by the FDA. And, you know, and once that happens, then the CDC will make a recommendation, you know, about how this vaccine fits in and how it should be used. So I think we'll all also be waiting to see that and to see what that recommendation is going to be going forward.
Well, Dr. Solansky, you've touched on this, but the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, it is much easier to store. So distribution should be easier for this one and the single shot. I would assume that this would have to help the entire country speed up the vaccination process when it comes to storing and vaccinating when you only need one shot compared to two.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no question about that. I mean, Dan is very involved in that process in the state of Missouri. Are there estimates, Dan, of how that's going to affect the distribution here in our state?
I think it will add to the efficiencies in our vaccination effort. But one thing I would add is that when you look at vaccine administration across our society, this is something that we are used to as far as having systems in place to support vaccination efforts. Whether we're talking about influenza vaccine or we're talking about some of the other immunizations that we receive just to stay healthy as a society. And so we have mechanisms in place to be able to support that. But by having something that has less stringent requirements as far as the cold storage, it will make it simpler for us to vaccinate our communities.
Another big talking point recently, and Dr. Slanski touched on it, is these COVID variants that are starting to emerge and being reported in the United States. So could you explain a little bit about these variants, why we're starting to see them, and whether vaccinating more people more quickly will help respond to these and maybe prevent them from popping up in the future?
Well, I think the knowledge that we have of most viruses is that one thing that they do is they mutate. Viruses change so that they can remain alive and infective. It's not unexpected that COVID-19 virus would mutate, and the SARS coronavirus, if you want to use the more technical term, you know, would mutate. The general thinking is yes, just as you suggested, Eric, that the more people we get vaccinated, the sooner we get people vaccinated, the more resistant they will be to even these mutant forms of the virus. We don't yet know for sure how much these vaccines will protect. And I think that's, again, part of the process that we're watching to see as these mutated viruses continue to spread around the globe. How are the people who've been vaccinated, how are they in responding to that? Do they get sick or not? And I don't know that we know all the answers yet, but the thinking generally is that vaccination is much better than not vaccination in terms of protecting against these mutant viruses.
We mentioned this a little bit earlier, but I wanted to dive a little deeper into it. Positivity rates have been declining in Jackson County recently. It's been a steady drop now. So what do you attribute that to, and what concerns you the most moving forward?
My opinion on that is that I think that there are several things that helped influence that reduction. One is people are complying with the health orders and being able to wear the mask, social distancing, being able to do the things that help reduce the spread of infection. An example of that is seasonal influenza is almost non-existent at this point in our state. Other diseases like RSV and things that we normally see during this time of year, they're just not seeing them in the healthcare system. So it shows that those precautions are making a difference. The other thing that I think helps as far as the social distancing impact is we've been dealing with some of these extreme weather situations, and we've had that's kind of helped to promote the social distancing in some of the situations where we haven't had the groups that have assembled as we've had in the past. And so once we get down to a level where that positivity rate is decreased, below 5%, that really is when you look at all the data that's been shared on studies across the country, that's when our risk is, showing that we've reduced the risk enough to be able to reduce or release some of the restrictions that we've been following at that point. But we still need to continue to maintain awareness, vigilance, and do surveillance across our society, because just as easy as it's decreased here, we can see an acceleration of the virus, another wave, so to speak, as we move forward.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Dan on the things that have helped us to get to this point where we're seeing such an improvement. I think also it helps. I think the length of time we are past the holidays, the big events where families were together, the longer we've gone past that, I think the less impact we've seen from those kind of spreader events. And I do think the vaccine has started to have an impact as well. We started getting vaccine in arms, in the end of late December and January, and we know that there is protective levels of vaccine, antibodies, within several weeks of the first vaccine doses for both Moderna and Pfizer. And in fact, there's some newer studies coming out suggesting that it may be even better than we thought, you know, even before the second vaccine comes around. So I really think that probably the fact that we were able to get so many people vaccinated in those high risk areas, in the nursing homes and other places, you know, obviously the healthcare workers and, you know, and now starting with people over the age 65 and with chronic health conditions, I think that first wave has made a difference as well. So I think it's a combination of factors. It's not any one thing. It's a combination of factors. And you asked, Eric, about what concerns about moving forward. For me, there's probably about three. One is something that Dan, I think, you know, sort of alluded to. It's the fact that people may get complacent. They may get complacent because they've gotten a vaccine and they think they don't really have to still do those mitigation factors of wearing a mask or physical distancing, hand washing, all the things we talk about. Or also, you know, because people are just, you know, we know that people are tired of the COVID, you know, isolation and wearing masks for some people, and that they're going to let their guards down, and that people will, particularly as we ease restrictions, they're going to think that you know, that means I don't have to continue to do those things. And so I worry about that. I do worry that that's going to be something that can potentially cause us to reverse those numbers in a bad way. I think a second thing that concerns me is just the general sense that there are still a significant number of people who are vaccine hesitant. And these are people who for a variety of reasons still do not feel that they want to get this COVID vaccine. If we don't have enough people get the vaccine to get to the herd immunity of around 70% vaccination, then we are not going to continue to get, you know, to move maybe to where we think we need to be to go back to what Dan was saying, you know, to our new normal. And so those two factors, plus just that factor that we really need to have efforts to have vaccine given to those areas of our community where people don't normally, you know, get vaccines. So the underprivileged, the people who may not regularly see physicians, people who, you know, who are in areas of the community where they may not have transportation to get the vaccines. You know, we have to have efforts to get to those, to get vaccine to those folks as well, to really have the best effect on the entire community to continue this, I think, in this positive downward trending of all the case numbers and hospitalizations and deaths.
Is there any final message that you would have to people listening to this regarding the vaccine, the pandemic, where things are currently and where things are headed?
Well, my final word would be, you know, these vaccines are proving to be, you know, very effective. They are safe. If you are in a category that is able to get the vaccine, you should get the vaccine. Once you get the vaccine, you need to continue to do all the mitigation strategies that we've talked about to help us to get through until enough people are vaccinated that we reach that herd immunity.
And I agree with those comments and think that, you know, the people that are really worried about getting the vaccine and the urgency to get the vaccine, the message would be that the vaccine will be available. It's going to take some time, but to be patient, we'll make sure that that vaccine is available for those that want to receive the vaccine. It's been forecasted that we'll have over 600 million doses of vaccine available within a few months. We're talking about July. But then anybody that is interested in receiving the vaccine would be able to go through the mechanisms that they normally would to get a flu shot or other immunization. But we're really focusing on being able to take care of those people at greatest risk and to help reduce the impact in our society.
Well, I appreciate you both taking the time to do this today. There's a lot of great information and information that I know the community is looking for. So thank you both.
Thank you, Eric.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the latest episode. You can find more information about the COVID-19 pandemic on the city's website, cityofls.net. We've compiled the latest vaccine information, testing sites, and more. The city also has a bi-weekly email newsletter called the Covering COVID-19 Community Briefing. You can subscribe on the city's website.